This is Payments Ground Game, where we go under the operational hood of payments ISOs. Let's take a deep dive into the tactics you can use to strategically scale performance and your bottom line. Welcome to another episode of Payments Ground Game. I'm Elena Smith. I'm here with Kevin Smith. And today we're going to do something interesting. We're going to talk about a topic that we presented at the Association of Payment Professionals, which if you're not familiar with that organization, they are great if you are at all involved in risk, underwriting, fraud prevention. They kind of focus on those areas. And so Kevin and I recently went to one of their regional events. They have several regional events. They also have an annual event. They do webinars. So if you at all touch those spaces, I would encourage you to connect with them. And the topic that we presented for them was the power of tech adding value across the payments ecosystem. And what we were trying to do with this was talk about the areas that you can visit for potential efficiencies in adding technology. Also, how you can add operational efficiency, how you balance those two things, because often when you try to manage operational efficiency, sometimes you add automation and you lose some of the power of the accuracy. So we were talking about the balance of those things. And then also how you explore potential solutions, because there are a lot of off-the-shelf products in the marketplace, and it's easy to get caught up in the new and shiny things. How do you see a potential solution and find the best fit for that potential solution? Or if you're starting at, hey, I have this problem I'm trying to solve, how do you find the best possible solution and then evaluate it to see if it's going to fit your needs? So what we're going to do is talk about the ways that we can use technology to manage risk and maximize operational efficiency. We'll talk about the areas that we should consider for improvement, and then we'll talk about the ways that we can evaluate possible solutions.
And throw in a couple of little real life scenarios.
Yes, that always brings it to reality in that we can talk about actual applications in the way that we've used technology to solve real problems. And I think that helps everyone relate to not just talking about these things in theory, but how you can do it in your business. So Kevin, why don't you talk about the different operational areas that we might consider adding technology or considering ways that we can use operational efficiency to help us in those business areas?
Well, obviously today we're talking about risk and underwriting, but really operational efficiency expands over the entire process within our operations ecosystem. So you're not just looking at risk and underwriting. You're also looking at, hey, are there things in here that can assist with customer service? Are there things in here that can assist with terminal deployment? Are there things in here that can assist us in general on a daily basis? And how can we get some of those departments to work better together? Does the tool help us have interoperability amongst our departments?
Okay, let's talk about some different operational areas that we might be able to address some of the issues that we face with technology solutions. Let's talk about fraud detection and prevention. We're familiar with some integrated and automated tools, I think, for underwriting and for decisioning and underwriting, I should say. Kevin, do you want to talk about some of those things that we use currently and some things that are out there that we're not using and the reason why we're not using those? I think that could help shed some light on the way that we make decisions in this area.
Obviously, when you want to look at something as a solution and you want to say, does this make us more efficient? Does it not make us more efficient? Does this assist us in making a better decision in whatever it is that we're doing? Take underwriting, for example. So for one of those, it's a good example is the IRS 10 match product. That today is a great product. The price is right. It's basically free if you integrate to their API. It's effective and efficient. It's either a green light go or a red light no in our system. So that helps in efficiency with its quick and easy and does a return. The problem is, and I'm sure some of you that have worked with this before in the past, it's great. It's free. It's fast. It works until it doesn't work. And then when it doesn't work, it's very difficult to get that up and running, because quite honestly, you're dealing with the damn government. We've had it go down for as long as 2 weeks at a time, but just trying to get the right people on the phone to help us get the solution solved. Now, we're willing to take this solution and use this solution today and use it moving forward, even though it has those difficulties at times, because it's the right price. Otherwise, you're having to, if you think about what are my other alternatives for using tin matching, there are other products that are out there. There are other products that are off the shelf that are out there today that are probably more reliable, but you know, you're looking at anywhere from $2 to $5 a pop every time you press that button to go say, does that work or not? So you've got to take and understand, is the product good? Does the product work? Is the product efficient? And what does it cost me to utilize that product? And that's just, I think, a great example of one of the products that we use, you know, why we use the one that we use.
And there's also an operational efficiency component to that, because anyone who has been in charge of doing 1099-Ks for their merchants will know that if you don't get the proper tin match and legal name, entity name match, the whole, hence the tin match is what we call it, with the IRS, they are going to send you a list of all those mismatches at the end of the year, and they don't do it systematically. They only send it to you on paper. So you will get several pages of mismatches, and you have to go through one by one and resolve those. Sometimes the name is slightly off. Sometimes they've provided an incorrect taxpayer identification number. And it's a manual process to resolve this. So by validating that match in the very beginning, you eliminate the need to have to go back and revisit after the fact. So yes, like Kevin said, it is a little bit of work to connect to the IRS and be able to do this process as part of your underwriting process. I think it's less of a risk thing and more of a, you know, let's gain some efficiency by not having to clean this up later when we do our tax reporting. I don't know how much risk we're really mitigating by making sure that our taxpayer identification number and our name match. Kevin, do you want to weigh in on that at all? I mean, I guess if they're trying to fake a business, they might get this slightly right or wrong, rather.
That is one of the indicators from a risk perspective, is if you're looking at this and they're giving you some bogus EIN number, then that, you know, brings the application into question. You know, but it is quick and easy to verify, and it is quick and easy. Once it's working, you click a button and it's green, move on to the next item. If it's red, you're going to go back and ask them, hey, please double check the EIN and make sure that the name is spelled correctly. You know, and in a lot of cases, we'll go back and just say, hey, just please provide us a copy of the EIN letter from the government. That's going to have the actual business name spelled as it should be, along with the EIN, so you can verify it.
Right. Another area that I think we can really leverage technology to help us make quick risk decisions is calculating risk scoring based on expected behavior and anomalies, things that went a different way than we might have expected to. So in this, we're trying to understand user and merchant behavior to prevent fraud. There are tools and software that can help us analyze behavioral patterns. And then scoring based on what we expect versus what happened that we didn't quite expect. Why don't you dive into that a little bit, Kevin?
Well, and I think that one of the things that a lot of the off-the-shelf tools miss out on this, they do the scoring correctly. They do, you know, hey, they give so many points if it's key. They give so many points if it's a foreign bin. You give so many points if they're above their daily average or their own pace to exceed their monthly average, or quite honestly, just the reverse, they're decreasing. The problem is most of these solutions, which, by the way, the scoring solution and looking at things from a scoring perspective has been around for, oh, good God, 20 years. But if you are not taking those scoring solutions and updating them at the merchant level at least every 30 days, and what do I mean by that? So you're scoring against a merchant, for example, for keyed transactions. He's getting a point because he shouldn't have keyed transactions, but he did. So he's getting a score for that. Well, what if over time this merchant moves from being card present to moves to being a card not present merchant? They change their business model. Well, you need to change that scoring system for that merchant. so that your risk system is not giving you false positives. Same thing with volume, same thing with average ticket. You should be updating whatever it is that you're using as your merchant level guide on at least a 30-day basis, every 30 days. That's one of the things that we built into our system that was really nice, because it allows us to evolve our risk process over time as the merchant evolves with us.
And one of the other things that I think is really important is being able to customize based on the makeup of your portfolio. If you have a portfolio that is largely convenience stores, that is going to be much different, and we are going to want to look at that much differently than one that, let's say, is based on future delivery, like travel, for example. So being able to customize the risk assessment that you do based on what is actually in that portfolio, because that's going to change based on everyone's own portfolio.
You know, and that's one of the things we talked about in that meeting. It was kind of interesting to hear others talk about, you know, hey, let's take a base risk flag, high ticket. So for us, our portfolio is made up of mostly small merchants with small average tickets. We have our, it doesn't mean that we don't have other merchants within our portfolio that have bigger average tickets, but for the most part, it's made up of merchants with small average tickets. So we have that flag set to show me anything that is greater than $1,000 run by a merchant on a given day. We also have a backup that runs a second flag that is a multiplier of the merchant's true average ticket. So if, for example, that merchant really has a $1,000 average ticket, he's not going to flag because his multiplier on his average ticket is going to be within reason, therefore not causing the flag. But others within that same group that we were talking to just the other day, Elena, were like, oh, I've got mine set at 5,000, or I've got mine set at 10,000, or I've got mine set at 500. It's all based on what is your overall view of your portfolio and how does it actually perform?
Agreed. And that's different for everyone. So we need to look at what is the makeup of that portfolio before we make decisions about setting those thresholds. The next one, I think, is the trickiest thing to do. It is the problem to solve. I don't think there's a great solution for it yet. There are some that do it fairly well, but that is authenticating the identity of the individual. This is getting so hard to do because of the tools available to fraudsters at this point. Let's talk about some of the options out there. Why do we even care that the person is who they say they are? Let's start with that, Kevin, first.
Well, it's just like anything else. It's, you know, a stolen identity. If I can go leverage credit in your identity and then default on that credit, that's your problem moving forward. It's not mine, and I ran away with it. You know, this is another interesting one that we had lots of discussion about during our conversation the other day. IDs, photo IDs, copies of a passport, things like that are getting very, very easy to digitally enhance, digitally change, digitally manipulate, and they're becoming more and more difficult to ascertain true identity based off of somebody giving you a picture of an ID. We require an ID. It's, that's a Synovus requirement for us. But we also utilize a product called Ideology, and several of the others that were there used that Ideology product as well. And what Ideology does is Ideology checks and looks at things other than just the ID, like is the person's address a known address? Has that address been used for that individual with a utility company? What is known previous addresses for that individual? Credit items. Do they have a pickup truck and with Ford Motor Credit? What color is it? So that's an easy on-off button for us as well. You know, literally we have an API for that. So you click on the button and it comes back and it says they either passed or they didn't pass. And if they didn't pass, it'll give you little items in there as to why they possibly didn't pass, such as no relevance to the address they gave you for their home address. So what you can then do is take that into a second level and do a conversation with the merchant over the phone and go through a questionnaire that Ideology provides for that individual that can help you identify or verify that that person is who they say they are. But that is, you know, this is one of the biggest issues we've got in our business today, I believe, is the identity theft. You know, and how are you going about making sure that you are doing business with whoever it is that they say they are?
And of course, we do have Match that we also use as part of our underwriting process. And if someone, if another acquirer reports someone as trying to get a merchant account by identity theft, they'll end up on the Match list. So that's one tool that we have. But I don't think it's a perfect situation because sometimes you get legitimate people who end up on the Match list who, you know, somebody was trying to steal their identity to open a merchant account.
Well, the whole thought process behind the Match list was well thought out and was there to allow acquirers to kind of have a list that says, hey, watch out for this guy. He did me wrong. Unfortunately, us being the credit card processing business that we are, and in the space that we're in, individuals have tried to use that and leverage that for means other than what it was intended for, i.e. somebody didn't pay their statement fee, so somebody will go put them on Match so that the only way they can get off Match is they got to go pay their statement fee, and then you can take them off Match and they can't go anywhere else. They kind of leveraged it as a collections tool, which is not what it was there for, which in turn, you know, taints and makes you take some of the Match stuff with a grain of salt.
Right. We have tools. They're not always perfect. We just have to do the best with what we've got, basically. Let's talk about another kind of facet of authentication, and that is authenticating the legitimacy of the business. So we've authenticated that the person is who they say they are. They are presenting this business that they want to set up with merchant processing. How do we validate that that business is a legitimate business?
Well, the question is legitimate business. Or is that business that they're claiming to be actually the person and the business that they're claiming to be? Or is it a false? Once again, we're back in that identity theft, except think of it this way. It's a business ID theft. So you can do several things. We use, obviously, the Secretary of State filings, looking those up at the individual state. That's going to show you information about that business, where it should be, where it was located, who the officers are, making sure that that matches up to the application that you have. Simple little things. Google the address. What comes up? If you Google the address and it's supposed to be a quickie mart and the address comes back that it's a field in the middle of Nebraska somewhere, there's obviously an issue there. But you also have problems with that because, quite honestly, you know, the Google Maps and things like that that you can use on the internet today are fairly accurate, but they're not always as up to date as they should be. But Google is your friend, as they always say. Google is your friend. Google the crap out of it. See what you come up with. Also, pull a who is on their website. If the business has been around for 10 years and when you pull a who is, it says their website was just started about a week ago, something's wrong. That doesn't make any sense. So you got to use common sense with the tools, and you've got to be able to take that, what the information that you're given, and filter through it and figure out what is the items that I want to use, what are the items I don't really worry about, et cetera.
I think this is one of the areas where we're starting to see a lot of products come to market that address this specific need. We actually looked at one of them recently, and this is an important lesson, I think, in balancing the cost that you pay for something and the value that you get from it. I'll let you tell that story, Kevin.
Well, you know, you first got to start off with, what is an acceptable amount? You have operational overhead associated with underwriting an application. It costs you to pull a credit report. It costs you time and salary to have an underwriter. It costs you, you know, every little thing that you're doing there. You need to figure out, this is what I spend in underwriting. I process this many apps. You know, what is my cost to underwrite an app? And we have a certain cost within our organization that we're trying to stay under. And I'm going to tell you, it's under $10 an application. If it's costing us more than $10 to review an application, we're in trouble. That's going to eat away at our operational overhead costs, and it's going to eat away at our profitability. So when looking at this, we ran into a product about 2 or 3 months ago where the individual came to us and said, hey, we've got this great product. You're going to be able to pull it. It's going to give you a business credit history. It's going to give you merchant processing data. And we said, whoa, wait a minute. So you're going to be able to tell us if that business processed before, and you're going to be able to tell us what their average volume was, what their chargeback ratios were. Oh, yes, 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 yes. We can do that. Well, as we started getting into it, it's like everything else. It's not quite as it seems. First off, it was way, way too expensive. You were looking at $15 a pull for this, which is crazy. That just blew our total underwriting number out of the water. The second thing was, once we started digging into it, we realized, ooh, it was, if that merchant had processed for this provider in the past, and it was a subset of providers. So the opportunity that that merchant would have processing history on that product was 20-25% chance. Otherwise, I've just spent $15 to get information I can collect somewhere else. So we decided to pass on that product. It was not going to provide any efficiencies for us. It was not going to give us any additional information that was going to help us make a decision on whether or not we want to take that deal. And quite honestly, it's too damn expensive.
And that's what I think you find when you start looking into a lot of these things. They look great. They have a fancy UI. They claim to solve all sorts of problems. But then when you take a step back and assess whether it really solves your problem at the cost that you want to solve it at, that's not always the case. So that's why we're going to walk through this process a little later about how do you evaluate potential solutions. But before we do that, another thing that I think that we can look at when we're analyzing these areas is, how do we eliminate and minimize redundant tasks? And we usually do that through efficiency, through automations. And that plays interestingly into the risk management process, because we don't want to make it so automated that we maybe add more risk because we don't have human eyeballs on things when we should have human eyeballs on things. But we also want to eliminate things that cause risk, like human error, where we're manually entering things and we enter a bank account incorrectly, and now we're hitting the wrong bank account. So it's a balance, I think, between these things of how do we increase efficiency, but without adding more risk. One of the things that we are really big on is working on a centralized platform. So rather than trying to work on all these different processor platforms, we've built our own so that we can work in this one place. It adds a ton of efficiency, first of all. It also minimizes the risk, because instead of trying to look at information from three different places, we have it all consolidated into one place.
Well, and we also sit down, we are very big on change. One of the things that I've always been big on is, just because we did it that way yesterday does not mean that that's how we're going to do it tomorrow. We have a meeting once a week in our office for about an hour, and we sit down with everyone and talk about what's going on in the different departments. And one of the first things that we always ask, that I always ask in those meetings, is, hey, what are we doing today that possibly we could change or do something with to be more effective and more efficient? Now, I'm not doing all of these processes every day myself. Neither is Elena. We have other people in the organization. So they're the ones that can provide us that information. And then we can evaluate whether or not automation of that is good or not. You know, is it effective? Is it going to make us more efficient? So those are some of the things we do. The other things, APIs. APIs are fairly easy to integrate, low on the cost scale from a research and development perspective. And then you can do things like, once you do that, so we have a thing that comes in when our ACH returns come in, that automatically, based off of the ACH return type, do we suspend that merchant moving forward? Do we stop all ACH activity, or do we just stop paying him positive amounts? So for example, if an ACH return comes in for RO1, which is insufficient funds, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and attempt to hit that account again, but we're probably going to hold all of their sales and only send out returns until we get that cleared, or we'll make three different attempts to try and clear that. Now, if I get an ACH reject that comes back that's an R29, and an R29 is account closed, okay, I'm not going to make any more ACH attempts at all, positive or negative, to that account, because I'm just going to get a reject back on that because that account is closed. And we automate the flow of that once that reject comes in, of notifying somebody in our organization to reach out to that merchant and get that corrected.
Right. It's all about thinking about rules that are specific to your business and finding ways that you can automate that process so that we're not doing dumb things, right? A lot of us are doing just things because we did them that way yesterday and not thinking about, wait a second, we're spending a lot of time manually doing this thing. What if we took a step back, figured out how to automate it, and now we're not having to have manual intervention in this, and it's doing it in a smarter way so that we gain some efficiency. All right, let's move forward and talk about we perhaps have a problem that we're trying to solve in our business, and we think there might be a technology solution that can help us solve this problem. So let's talk about the evaluation process that we can use to find the best solution, make sure it's going to be a good fit for us, and then move forward with implementation.
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is we actually have to sit down and be honest with ourselves. Do we really have a problem, or do we not have a problem? And then once we decide whether we have a problem or we don't have a problem, you know, it's kind of like a decision tree. You go down the decision tree. Yes, go to the left. No, go to the right. You know, but once we evaluate this, we have it. We think we have an issue and we think we have a solution to it. What is that solution? Is that solution something that requires human intervention? Is it not something that requires human intervention? Is it something that, you know, is going to be an outsourced product, or what are the research dollars for development that we're going to have to spend to fix this? So, for example, if you have a problem, $10 a month problem, do you go spend $5,000 to fix your $10 a month problem? No, you don't. What you do is you either decide to live with your $10 problem, or you look for a different solution. So these are the things that you're going down and you're trying to decide. But the first thing, and I think most people miss this, Elena, is they don't even sit down and make sure they really have a problem. Make sure you really have a problem before you go down the evaluation process.
And I think there's three kind of areas that you should look at when you're defining this problem and understanding for your company, is this something that fits in with something that we want to solve? Does it fit in with our risk management strategy? Does it fit in with our compliance needs? Does it fit in with our operational priorities? And look at those three areas and make sure that it's something worth exploring. And on the risk part, I think that we really have to understand what our tolerance for risk is, and assess whether this solution is going to solve for that and eliminate unwanted risk. And we have to be honest with ourselves in this part. I'll give an example of a couple of years back. We had a merchant who submitted a fictitious bank statement. And we only found this out, unfortunately, after we boarded them. Once it was boarded, it was very clear to us that it was fraud. Fortunately, we were able to stop it quickly. But as we were going back into underwriting and figuring out what went wrong, what did we miss? We looked at the bank statement, and it was very clear that this was a made-up bank statement, because as you were doing the math of, you know, the current balance on the bank statement, the things weren't adding up quite right. And so somehow in my LinkedIn feed or somewhere else popped up, you know, oh, this new solution that can look at bank statements and immediately tell you whether they are, you know, valid or not. And so I said, Kevin, we need to, you know, this is something that we really need. We've got to implement this immediately. This can never happen again. This happened to one merchant. Also, the tools that are creating these fake bank statements, I imagine that this scenario was someone actually manually creating this, but now with AI, it's quite easy to create a valid bank statement where all of the math works. So if we had implemented that tool, it would have cost us an awful lot of money, and it wouldn't be solving a problem any longer for us. So it's really important to be honest with yourself what the problem actually is. The problem with that one was actually in underwriting. we didn't take a close enough eye to that bank statement. And I think there might have been a couple of other indicators as well that we just missed because we like to be speedy in our underwriting. Did we really have a problem that we needed a tool to solve? No, we did not. We really just needed to take a closer look at that actual component of the application. And like I said, it was a one-off. If we had implemented a tool, it would not really solve an ongoing problem for us. So we need to be honest with ourselves about what our needs are, where the exposure is, and how do we best solve for that exposure?
Well, and I will tell you, Elena, some of the things that, you know, I have always found interesting. If you are doing underwriting correctly in this business, you don't need an automated auto approval process. There is no reason, if you are doing underwriting correctly, if you are using the appropriate tools, that a human should not be able to look at each deal. The past, everybody said, oh, we got to have, you know, automated approvals because I don't want anybody spending time on looking at these subsets of merchants. They can just get auto approved. Well, what happens in that scenario is people figure out what your auto approval stuff is. And then guess what? Every deal you get meets those guidelines, whether it really does or it doesn't. If you're doing underwriting correctly, you should be able to efficiently and effectively underwrite deals in a reasonable time frame, to where you can still provide almost automated responses. But there's nothing that's going to hurt for you to look at a bank statement. Does it make sense? Look at a processing statement. Does it make sense? If you look at the bank statement and the processing statement from the merchant, and they're from the same month, you have deposits going out on the processing statement. Do they show up on the bank statement? These are things that human eyes have to look at.
Right. It's a lot of common sense. I mean, when it comes down to it, it really is. But we get so into the fanciness of these tools that we get lost on the common sense part, I think, sometimes. Okay, the next big area that we're going to look at is assessing the technology fit. So does this product fit for our organization? We're going to look at things like scalability. If we're growing, can it scale with us? We are going to look at, can it change with our regulatory and compliance requirements? Very important, because those are constantly changing. Compatibility, is it compatible with our existing software platforms? Do we have to do any customization to plug it into that? What effort is going to be required from us to integrate to our existing software platforms? And then, is it flexible? Like we were talking about scoring earlier, we are going to have specific needs for merchant scoring based on the makeup of our merchants. Are we going to be able to customize it so that we get information that's meaningful to us, not just information that's meaningful to, you know, 75% of the other portfolios that are out there, because we could be a little different.
Well, you also got to make sure, I think, you know, from the scalability standpoint, hopefully your organization is growing. If your organization is not growing, you're dying. That's just reality. I know nobody wants to talk about that, but that is reality. So you have to make sure that this is going to be able to meet your business needs today, but it's also going to meet your business needs tomorrow. Nothing's worse than putting something into production, spending development dollars on it to get it there, and then find out a year later that, you know, quite honestly, it's just not scalable and you can't utilize it anymore. When speaking about those things as well, you want to think about from a development standpoint, it may seem a little expensive to invest in it today, but if it is scalable and it really does solve your problem, okay, hey, you're going to get that in return within a short period of time, especially if it's scalable and you can scale out.
Absolutely. The next thing I think we need to look at is evaluating reputation and support. Ideally here, I think if you can find someone else who's using this tool in a similar way that you plan to use it, I think that's always the best. If you can get some kind of firsthand account of the way that this tool is working. Also, if you need support from this vendor, do they show up when you need support? That's huge. If you have a tool and you have some issue with that tool and you go to find support and they don't show up, you're stuck, and then the tool becomes useless. So know whether they show up and support the product that you're going to spend time to integrate, spend money on implementing, use resources to implement. You want to make sure that they are going to show up for you in the way that you need them to.
Well, and also sit down with whoever it is that you're doing business with. Sit down with your sponsor bank. Sit down with the individuals that you're working with in conjunction for underwriting or risk, et cetera. Make sure that it's a product that they're okay with. Nothing's worse than you run down, you think you've got something whiz-bang 3000 implemented, and next thing you know, the sponsor bank's like, yeah, that's not reliable. We don't trust that. Well, now you've wasted all this money. You have this product. It may help you a little bit, but it's not meeting the need or covering the umbrella that your sponsor bank wants you to have as far as from an underwriting and risk perspective. So, yeah, work with those that you're working with and make sure that, you know, we won't implement anything from an underwriting and risk perspective until we sit down and talk to our sponsor bank about it. You know, if they don't give a crap about it, you know, is it really then something I'm going to implement that solves an issue for me? Probably not.
The next thing I think we need to think about when we are evaluating potential solutions is automation. We've talked about this a little bit. How much automation can we gain by implementing this product? How much human error and redundancy can we eliminate by implementing this product? And then that balance between if we're automating, do we add risk? So we need to think about that. If we're making this an automated process and we're missing important things that human eyeballs are typically looking at, are we introducing any risk in the process by automating?
Didn't we cover that with our friends over in the auto approval process?
Yes, we did. That's exactly what we're talking
about. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Let's move on. Let's talk about next. We need to evaluate how we are going to protect sensitive data as part of these solutions. Because when we're talking about risk and underwriting, we are talking about sensitive data like personally identifiable information, proprietary business information, possibly card numbers, things that are affected by PCI. So that's definitely something we need to consider. Are the tools that we're evaluating plugging in, do they comply with these requirements so that we don't expose ourselves in this way and expose, you know, information as part of the process?
A pretty simple process here. Who's seeing the data? Should they see the data? If not, fix it. Remember, PCI is only worried truly about PAN data for card numbers. So most everybody today is either going to truncate or they're going to mask PAN data. That's really not an issue like it was years ago in our industry. But things that are out there today, you know, hey, not everybody in customer service needs to see the full account number or the full routing number associated with a particular merchant. Not everybody, nobody really needs to see the Social Security number except for underwriting. Nobody needs to see really the home address for that individual in full unmasked perspective. So just who does need to see it? Make sure they have the capability to see it. Those that don't really need to see it, don't let them see it.
All right. The final component, I think, that most people love to skip over because it can be a painful component. And again, it's an exercise in honesty, I think. And that is the cost-benefit analysis. We can't just choose a tool because it seems like it's an amazing UI and a cool product. There has to be some kind of return on investment. It has to make sense between what are we going to get back in value from this product. And when we look at the cost of this product, we not only need to look at what is the initial outlay, but then also the ongoing things like updates, maintenance, licensing. If you build this yourself, it's never just the cost of building it yourself. It's having to maintain it after you've built it. And even when you get off-the-shelf solutions, often there's a cost to maintain those off-the-shelf solutions after you've bought them. So looking at return on investment is important.
Well, and I can always tell you, no matter what number your development group gives you, multiply it times three. No matter what time frame they give you, multiply it times three. If it still makes sense, then move forward. We've worked with great development groups in the past, and we work with some poor development groups in the past, but none of them have ever been accurate on what it costs or how long it takes to get there.
Absolutely. So that wraps us up for this episode, The Power of Tech, Adding Value Across the Payments Ecosystem. Again, this is the same presentation that we did for the Association of Payment Professionals. If you want to check that out, you can check out their website, paymentpros.org, to learn about their upcoming events and how you can plug in and get involved with them. And we will see you next time.
Have a good one.